Have you given any thought to contributing to The Melt? It's easy to do. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and for as little as $3 a month, you can get access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. It helps to keep the magic happening here at The Melt. So I encourage you to karmically entangle yourself with The Melt today by subscribing monthly for less than the price of a container of goatee wax, or a prosthetic pinky, or a half stick of DMT butter, or an inflatable casket, or the shrunken head of an Atlantean supermodel, or a woolly mammoth's merkin, or a crystalline replica of Baba Yaga's hut, or a capsule of Sasquatch dander.
This is Hunter Muse.
And this is Chris Snipes. And you are listening
to The Melt.
At this point for me, the flat earth question is less about being right and more about being open to radically new, yet not so new, concepts. We have farmed out experiential existence and natural curiosity so long to experts that we've stopped trusting our own perceptions of the world and reality. It harms absolutely no one to ponder such a seemingly preposterous idea of a flat earth, but so many are relegated to the island of condemnation for even giving the idea of flat earth the time of day. Listen how this asshole named Professor Dave demeans David Weiss.
This gas and dust in space, in a vacuum, in zero pressure, how does that work? How come this doesn't collapse in on itself? This is just a...
It does. That's how stars are born. Yeah, they do collapse. It's how stars form.
Dave, in your world, this is gases are collapsing upon themselves and then igniting themselves in a vacuum, in a vacuum. And then they burn billions of years.
Look, I know that you want to just spew your script without anybody challenging, but you say so many stupid things, and I'm here to tell you why everything you're saying is stupid. So when you say stars igniting in a vacuum, the reason that's confusing for you is that you think stars are little bonfires. Because you're a moron. Because you don't understand nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is the process by which stars glow. They're not little fireballs. And you can learn that by Googling something for 5 seconds, but you don't do it.
Now, I don't call Professor Dave an asshole because I'm on Team Flat Earth and he's not. I call him that because he's behaving like one. I really don't like the flat earth issue as yet another reason for people to get puffy chested about their opinion on the matter. When I hear a flat earther call someone a globetard, it's as grating to me as, well, Professor Dave. But what does fascinate me about the concept are all of the implications of the cosmology of a closed system and the strange correlations that it does have with things mentioned in the Bible and the countless cosmologies of ancient peoples. To me, it does make some strange sense that we might be inside of a firmament where nothing physical can leave and that the path that science has taken with all of its godless reductionist materialism is meant to weaponize this enclosed system in order to encourage us to think that this is all there is. Short, brutish lives bound in coarse matter, created randomly and existing for no reason. No wonder we think it's the same shit, but a different day. Reality is magical and multifaceted, and like any experiment in quantum physics, is affected by the observer, which means that the observer is actually a participant, which means that reality is fluidic and ever-changing, but our institutions and fields of study often aren't. They become calcified and stagnant because they are apt to corruption and subject to financial obligations. We must break out of this cycle. We must get back to our place in the natural order. We must be open to things that seem preposterous. Today's guest, Flat Earth Clue Finder Mark Sargent, joins us today to speak about the above and much more. I start off the conversation by asking Mark how he first became interested in the subject at hand.
I am what some people would consider to be the Flat Earth recruiter, meaning if you get into the whole concept of us being in living in some sort of enclosed world, you're probably going to run into my stuff first. And I got into it in the summer of 2014 when I had ran out of conspiracies to look at. And it's like, yeah, this seems like a great idea. I'll just tick this off my list. I'm not getting any younger. And 9 months later, I'm banging my head on the keyboard. And so in 2015, I made a series of videos called The Flat Earth Clues. And it was basically just a cry for help, and put them out on the internet with all my contact information and said, yeah, you know what, internet hive mind, hit me with whatever you got, because I'm pretty sure I got this one nailed down. And instead of some academic calling me, everybody else did. So 7 years later, here we are. A whole bunch of stuff has happened since then.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have two books out?
Yes, Flat Earth Clues, The Sky's the Limit, which is based on the original Flat Earth Clues, and then Flat Earth Clues, End of the World, which is a little play on words there, because, you know, I could have said Edge of the World, but End of the World. So two books on Amazon, and I wrote a survival guide, which is on Amazon, and then the Netflix documentary and a whole bunch of other little things. So, yeah, a lot of stuff.
Is it still on Netflix?
No, it ran, you know, it was on Netflix for so long that it ran its contract out.
Oh, wow.
So it was on for 3 years, and then they lost the rights to it. And so now it's on Amazon and iTunes and YouTube Red and all the other places you can find. So
fantastic. We have yet to see it, but perhaps we should peruse
it. You really should if you get a chance. It is. I know that David hates it, but it is a very objective look at the, I mean, it's a fair look at a snapshot of the Flat Earth community back in 2017 when we shot it.
Why does David hate it? Is it not flattering?
Well, he's probably our biggest purest Flat Earth cheerleader, meaning, you know, it's got to be, it's Flat Earth or it's nothing, right? There is no middle ground. Scientists and astrophysicists, anyone wearing a lab coat should all be put on a ship and sunk, right? But it wasn't, if you want to use a drug reference, it wasn't pure uncut Flat Earth. It was very diluted. So it was like, because I sat with studio audiences in different film festivals, you know, watching this thing. And it was like, you know, it's like flat earth, people getting tense. It's like, okay, good, there's a scientist. Okay, it's safe. Flat earth, it's an astronaut. It's fine. And it would go back and forth like that to Burr at the end of the 100 minutes. People were just, you know, they felt safe going in. That was the whole point. And he understood that it generated a huge amount of a buzz in the community that year. So mm-hmm. Good for us.
And you, are you much of a debater? I know Weiss likes to go into the ring with people who are just ready to shoot him down. And I haven't really seen you in those same sorts of situations.
Most of the time I don't. Okay. So it's wonderful. You know, no one's ever asked me that. I have the answers for that question. David gets into debates because of how he gets approached. Meaning, if I ever live long enough to write an autobiography, it'll be called Unsolicited. I never had to pick up the phone. People just kept calling me with all this stuff. David has people that will call every podcast and say, hey, you want to talk to a flat earther, right? And depending on who they are, yeah, I mean, some people might be receptive, but other people are like, oh yeah, I want to talk to a flat earther. I got some things to say. And so David will go into hostile environments all the time, whereas I hardly ever get into hostile environments. Plus, because of what I'm told my nature, There was this New Zealand journalist. He was the only person to say it. And he goes, Mark has this goofy warmth that instantly disarms you. And I no one had ever said that about me before in my life. And I was going, and so I started out, I go, goofy warmth? Is that a thing? And they're going, yeah, that's it. And I'm going, oh, wow. So yeah, hardly anyone. And I mean, I've gone against people that should have torn my head off and they didn't. The most notable being like Piers Morgan. Oh my God. I was so nervous going into that one because I'd watched him on different things. I'm going, he's going to tear me apart. It's not going to be fun at all. And so I'm like, you know, bracing myself, and he was fine. He was absolutely, he did not say a disparaging word the entire time. And I'm going, huh? That whole disarming thing must actually work. So,
anyway. It's also a sign of maturity. I don't remember who I watched. It was Dave and three other guys. And only one was really, his name was Professor something. I don't remember what his name was.
That was the Professor Dave interview.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Oh, that was
so
brutal.
Condescending and rude.
If you knew anything about this guy, I highly recommend anyone that listens to this watch the documentary Fake Famous, which is, a lot of people don't realize that in the social media world, hits and likes and subs, they are the currency. And you can buy them like anything else. You do not have to earn them. You can buy them. And some people in our community, I'm sure, have bought them. And some trolls have bought them. And this guy, Professor Dave, and I only knew this because when I was listening in the background to that debate you were talking about. And they said, oh, and on our channel, the biggest sub, you know, subscribe, you know, big, biggest subscriber base that we've ever seen, you know, guy with 2 million subs. And I turn around and go, 2 million who? Who's got 2 million subs? And it's like Professor Dave, I'm going, the hell he does. And there was, you know, you got that chat room in the side, you know, the live chat room. Mm-hmm. And there was maybe pushing 1,000 people in there, which is pretty good, you know, for a live chat.
Sure.
They were all us. So if he has 2 million subs and all those people are us, where is people at?
Exactly.
So yeah. So his only defense is to name call. I mean, you know, and it was embarrassing to watch. I put a comment in that thing, and I don't usually comment on a lot of those videos, where I said, when you open in the first 5 minutes with idiot, moron, stupid, and I mean, just nonstop, it was tough to listen to. Very, very tough to listen to. It was like a clinic on how not to debate somebody.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you know that person is the opposite of open-minded, which you have be with a subject like this, you know?
Yeah. And that, you gotta remember, that's why his channel was born. He is a pro troll channel that his whole base is to attack flat earth. That's all it is. So he had to go in doing that. Now he went even over, I think, over the top for his base, you know, even his base. It wasn't fun to listen to, I think, from anybody's standpoint.
Yeah. Although anyway. The other guys, I don't know who they were. One jolly English dude.
Oh, they were the moderators.
Oh, okay. They were
it was their channel.
They were snickering like grade school kids, you know, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I wish I could say that.
They told David that they were going to moderate. And at one point I saw them do it. They just turned off their mics. They just hit mute on their mics. And they were going on a separate back channel where they were going, oh, this is great. These guys are just, and David wasn't going to take the bait, wouldn't take the bait. And it was because of what I mentioned earlier, it's like, you're calling Dave names. That's just another Tuesday for Dave.
Exactly.
This guy is not going to do anything to him. The only thing that Dave was upset with was he couldn't get in his points. The guy was just, you know, that Dave was supposed to make a point and the moderators would be, oh, let Dave talk. And it's like, Nope. This other guy just, that was awful.
Yeah, it was. It was embarrassing. I felt bad for Dave, although he seemed unflinching. I think
he's bulletproof.
Yeah. Exactly.
Plus, he's got that app, which is so wonderful.
It is. It's seamless.
When you quit your career and do this full time and build this app and put everything you have into it and have it turn out the way it did, I mean, it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely. So what is the term that I came across in your second book, Flat Earth 2.0? What is that?
Flat Earth 2.0. So the original Flat Earth is not a new concept, obviously, which is why it's amazing that it's gotten this big resurgence over the years. Flat Earth for the longest time was just this old concept, right? That's everyone knows about Flat Earth. It's the only thing we debunk to children. you know, no, we do not talk about any other conspiracy ever to children, but in kindergarten or first grade, depending on when you come in, they all do the same thing, which is like, oh yeah, by the way, this is the globe. We used to think it was flat. Now it's the globe. And then they put it in the corner of the classroom and it just stays there silent for 12 years minimum. And that's brilliant. So the old school flat earthers really didn't do much, even when the internet came out. They really weren't doing much. In fact, you could look up the original Flat Earth Society. In fact, I didn't know. In fact, I still got my original card, I think, lying around here. I actually signed up for the Flat Earth Society back in 2014. This is my proof that, because I was the people that I went out and made a video saying, don't go to this website. Do not do it. Because it's controlled by trolls. The velvet rope is actually run by trolls. And I'm going to think, there's only 500 people in that whole thing. And yet you've got dedicated trolls that are sitting up in front going, there's nothing to see here. Move along. Nothing to see here. It's all a joke. Just move along. And it's like, why would you even be bothering? I mean, trolls, to all the trolls out there, if you want to watch people cry, if you want to make people cry, you can go on YouTube all day long and make people cry. That's not hard. You can go into any room you want, just thumbs down, make a nasty comment, and you can torture people. And to that point, there was a joke I made where, but I wasn't kidding, you know, because I'm old enough to remember when the internet was very, very new, which was, if you could make a video that has puppies and kittens playing in a children's cancer ward, and within 100 hits, guaranteed, within 100 likes, someone's going to come in there and go, this is gay, thumbs down, unsubbed, I hate everything. And just because they can. And it's like, there's no reason to do that. It's like, no, they don't care. They're just hateful, hateful people.
Exactly.
So anyway, sorry, circle back. Not Nancy Pelosi. No, not. Who's circle back? The press secretary who's leaving.
Jen
Psaki.
Jen Psaki. Yeah. Not circle back. She's ruined the term circle back, just so you know. She's absolutely ruined it. I used to use it. I try and refrain from doing it. So what happened was, when social media started coming out, that Flat Earth Society wasn't doing anything. And so we just ignored them. And we just started doing our thing, mostly on YouTube. If it wasn't for YouTube, I wouldn't even be talking to you now. And it was like a year and a half after we were just ripping it up in the metrics on YouTube, just shredding them. And all of a sudden I get this guy, never heard of him, called me and said, oh yeah, I'm from the Flat Earth Society. I really like what you're doing. Thumbs up, blah, blah, blah. I'm going, no offense, man, but where the hell have you been? Who are you? Why haven't you? You should have been there since minute one. And I said, look, we don't need you. So you can just keep doing what you're doing. And they did. They never did get involved. We did conference after conference. I mean, 2019, I did conferences in 7 countries. They never once got involved in anything. And this is we're talking about a group whose founding member, he wasn't the number one on the list of just because of popularity, was Thomas Dolby, the musician.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, his second album is called Flat Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've never spoken to the guy ever. All these other celebs came out, but Thomas Dolby never talked to anyone. There you go. So, well, yeah, we are Flat Earth 2.0. We don't care about the original Flat Earth Society. So everything up until 2015, Flat Earth 1.0. Everything after 2015, 2.0, which is us.
Gotcha. Well, how much of just going right into mainstream science, how much do you think of mainstream science is based on a guess or a bluff? Because that's what a lot of this challenge is. People always bring up the science card when Flat Earth comes to the step up to bat. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a wonderful question. And yeah, a lot of it, unfortunately, science, I think Tesla said it best, and you probably know this quote where he said that the problem with science is that, yeah, they're built on the shoulders of everybody else when you get to a certain level, but everybody that climbs on the shoulders never checks out the foundation, never reflects on the original foundation. So he goes, by the time you get up to like 6, 7, 8, 9 people up, he goes, the equations mean nothing. Because the chance of error is huge. And science makes mistakes. Neil deGrasse Tyson, one of the most arrogant things I've ever heard in my life was when he said, science is true whether or not you believe in it. which means that science, we put our stamp on science, that's it, that's what you have to go on. But my quote is, the science is true only until the day it's not. And unfortunately, when it's not, they never apologize for it. One of my favorite science examples was a stupid fish called the coelacanth from years ago. It was an ugly fish with a bunch of extra fins, and they found fossils of it and years ago, and they said, well, it's obviously been extinct for 70 million years. And every scientist in the world, every single one of them, would have put the bet the farm on it that this thing was gone for 70 million years. Well, then the British Navy caught one off of South Africa, and then another one off of Mozambique, and then another one off of Madagascar. And pretty soon, all of a sudden, National Geographic swimming, you know, got scuba divers going, hey, you know, these things are everywhere, right? So the question is, how did they get that so completely, absolutely put in a certificate you can frame wrong? And the reason is because, well, they reinforce each other without checking each other's work. Meaning it's like, well, I obviously the pictures of the fossils and this guy, we've done so many studies on these fossils, have to be right. It's like, well, yeah, but they weren't. They weren't. And I use cryptozoology, which is, you know, the animals thing so often because it's so easy to do. Until the giant panda was found, it was an absolute myth and they laughed at it. And same thing with the giant anaconda and the giant squid. Giant squid is one of my favorite examples because we still never caught one of the big ones. The only reason we even know this they exist is because we found the remains in the, you know, the bellies of sperm whales that came to the surface. You'll never catch one. Ever, ever, ever. Peter Benchley, the guy that wrote Jaws, would have loved to have made a movie, a full-blown movie about the giant squid, because it was just, they eat great white sharks every once in a while just for fun. It's just amazing. Anyway, science does that all the time with things, and I have thrown questions at them time and time again. They just look at me with blank stares. One of my favorites, and we probably might get into this later, was there was a astrophysicist from Georgetown University who was approached by a German television team. It's like, you and Mark, you're going to do a debate, but we know that scientists don't like debates because, you know, apparently when you get a PhD, you have a hard time talking for whatever reason. You just get really tunnel visioned. You do. You get so focused that articulation just goes out the window. So it's like, okay, we're going to record video things from each of you and just pass them like notes in class. You're never going to talk to each other. It's like, oh, okay. And so I gave him five science questions and he folded, and that was it. And to be fair, one of the reasons he folded is because when they get so specialized, they're really uncomfortable talking about things that aren't in their wheelhouse.
Yeah,
so they'd rather just say, yeah, I can't talk about that, so we're not going to do it. So
yeah, that makes sense. And a lot of people think that science is this institution that is totally unbiased and doesn't have a narrative or an agenda at all, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Science, you know, I made a clue called They Are Hiding God, but there, you know, which is that science, once the foundation of science was built, they started developing their own agendas, and they really became their own church own high priests. And as we develop technological advances within our civilization, they, through osmosis, grabbed more and more people in. But again, it was just in the general umbrella of science. So yeah, they got their own agenda, but I don't know, unless maybe at the highest levels, do they even know what they're doing? The big one for us, though, was the reinforcement of space, which I'm sure David mentioned many times, which is just about every story. And we now look at the subtext. There's two things we've noticed. One is they run regular, like a drumbeat, stories about space. Just, you know, and it doesn't matter if you even read the article. It's like, oh yeah, there's something funny on the top of Saturn. There's the spot on Jupiter's weird. We're reclassifying Pluto and blah, 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 blah. Oh, and every month there's some near Earth asteroid coming by, or it's every freaking month now. And it's all the subtext is because you're living in a globe in impossible space. Over and over and over, they would do this, you know, Mars space, Jupiter space, and Saturn space, and all that. The other thing they do, and I don't know if they do this through Hollywood deliberately, but we've become hyper aware of it, is it doesn't matter what television show or movie you've watched in the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years at least, you will find globes in places that should not be there. And there was this little story about, and I'm we're talking, I mean, yeah, fine, classrooms, I get it, right? But why is there always a globe on the top of a filing cabinet in a detective's office in New York or Chicago or whatever, or in a doctor's office or this multi-billionaire's office? Just these weird random globes, and they're always in frame. And you say, oh, well, it's just happenstance. It's like, no. No, it's not. And there was this little story that came out about 3 or 4 years ago about hidden producers. One of the easiest things to do in the world, if you know anything about Hollywood, which is you can walk into any studio and say, hey, I'd like to donate $20,000, $30,000 to your television production and or movie. And it's like, okay, what do you want for it? You want a credit? Nope, don't want a credit. Do you want a percentage? Nope, don't want a percentage. What do you want? I want to help stage this particular room in this scene in this script. It's like, all right, they'll take your money. They don't care. They're like, hell yeah, we'll take it. Sure. What the hell do we care? And so the silent producers, and so they'll change a color here, change there, and then they'll put a globe somewhere. And it's just one of the weirdest things. So between those two reinforcements, and of course, putting the globe in the classroom for every student right underneath the American flag for years and years, it's the most amazing conditioning ever. Sorry. Long-winded answer to your thing.
It's like ambient heliocentrism.
It is. Well, think about the globe in the classroom. Again, remember, after 12 years, you know, the American flag in the classroom, there's people that join the military half based on the fact they've seen the flag so many times.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, it's flag where I live. I'm willing to fight for that. Oh, yeah, it's the globe. That's where I am. I'm willing to fight for that, too, if there was a way to do it. You enter Space Force.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
Space Marines is a real thing, right?
Starship Troopers.
Oh God! Or well, heck, Starship Troopers or Aliens, the sequel, yes. The James Cameron movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Or the comedy, the sitcom called Space Force now that's out there with Steve Carell. I can't even sit through it.
I've never heard of that.
Oh my God! You ought to watch it. It's called Space Force, and it is about this fifth branch of the military that's just this parody of itself and this joke. Although I think they do go to the moon at one point, but whatever.
Yeah, crazy.
But it's a comedy, obviously, with Steve Carell headline in it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a comedy.
Right.
It's probably more like cringe fest.
That's right. I can't sit through it. It's just painful.
Yeah, Steve Carell, not a big fan of him anyway. But so there are many people who might not know this who aren't into Flat Earth and haven't looked into it, but there's various different sort of forms of cosmology. Like there's the puddle theory.
Right.
There's the, you know, the bubble theory of being inside of a firmament.
Yep.
What could you maybe go over a few of those and describe?
Not everyone in the Flat Earth community, and you'll know this if you end up watching the documentary, which is that only about 70-75% of the community even believe in a dome. Everyone believes it's flat. Right. In fact, most people believe in our community believe it's tabletop flat, but only about 70% believe that we're in living inside like a Truman Show, you know, that there's a big snow globe thing on top of us. And then there's another group of people and we're kind of mixed on, you know, is this a one off, which I doubt, you know, or are there more of these things, you know, more puddles, you know, if you're going to make one, why would you just make one, make more, you know, with different stages of evolution or whatever you want to call it. But my only argument against the non-dome theory goes along with the whole air pressure versus vacuum problem, which is really a big issue, which is thermodynamics says that pressure cannot exist next to non-pressure without a barrier.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so the same, you blow up a balloon with your hand, you let go with your fingers a million times, it's going to take off because the pressure is trying to equalize. And there's so many other examples of that. The one I throw at people in science, I have yet to find a scientist that'll come at me, which is let's say your room, let's say there's a second story above your room and you turn it into a little vacuum chamber, you have a valve and you pull it, right? And you pop the cap on that thing. What happens? Well, it's not like the movies. The movies are wrong so many times for plot issues, right? Which is the air equalizes absolutely instantly. It's violent. It's horrible. It's not like, we only got 2 minutes of air left. Get the duct tape and put on the spacesuits. No. It's you're done. That is over. So the air will rush up immediately upstairs into your room, equalizing. So why? Well, because the power of that vacuum just destroys gravity, right? The smaller example is you know, sucking soda out of a glass. You know, you create a small vacuum force. Well, when you walk outside, why is our atmosphere still here? And because it's like, well, because we've got an atmosphere sitting next to the biggest vacuum of all time, if you believe mainstream science, right? And people, a knee-jerk reaction, because it's the only answer they have in science, is, well, it's got to be gravity. You mean the same gravity that couldn't keep the air in your room just now from going upstairs? The exact same gravity? I even had a guy stop in mid-sentence. He said, well, there's more. I go, more gravity? Really? More? Is that what you're going to say? So if that's the case, then the dome theory really, really holds a lot better. I mean, doesn't the whole greenhouse gas effect, you know, mean a lot more if it's an actual greenhouse?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole, I never understood as a kid anywhere. The fluorocarbons and everything, they get up to the top, and then what exactly? Will you just stay there? It's like, no. No, they'd be shredded. They'd take off. I've even had one person, let me give one quick example for you. I had one person say, well, it's really thin and kind of wispy up there, and so the vacuum doesn't have a lot to pull off of. And I go, that is not how it works at all. So I'll give you the quick example. The example I had was, we'll take an ordinary cardboard box, an Amazon box. How's that? And inside that box, you make sure the bottom is held together by only a little bit of tape, right? So it has very little resistance. And you put some packing popcorn in there. Pick up the box. What happens? Nothing happens. Right? Because the packing popcorn doesn't weigh anything.
Yes.
Well, you put the box back down and then grab a whole bunch of books and put it on top of the packing popcorn, right? And then try to lift up that same box. What's going to happen? The books are just going to punch. It's going to push everything straight down and everything's going to fall to the floor. There you are. Everything's going to fall to the floor. Well, it's like, okay, what's that analogy of? Well, that would be the atmosphere. The vacuum of space doesn't care about that packing popcorn at the edge of space. It's going after everything. It's going after the packing popcorn. It's going after the books. It's going after the oceans. Everything that's not nailed down, and some of it, would be just completely torn off. Mm-hmm. And never, no one ever touches it. So,
well, and also there is, by researching this, I found out there's a lot of people who believe in a firmament because of the Bible.
Sure.
It's mentioned all the time.
Sure. Genesis 1:8, if I'm not mistaken, firmament separating the waters above and the waters below.
Yeah.
Or the tombstone of Wernher von Braun, which I thought was very intriguing, yeah. And I will take credit for that one. Which is it's just, you'd think it'd be this giant, you know, Wernher von Braun, right? You think it'd be this giant statue with him pointing at the sky and a big racket behind him. No, it's just this modest headstone. The year he was born, the year he died, and then Psalms, I think it's 19:1. And I had to look it up. I was going, what is it said? And he's not a religious guy, or at least I didn't think he was. And the verse says, and the firmament shows his handiwork.
Like,
why would the father of rocket science be reaching out from the grave and throwing that little breadcrumb out there? Don't know.
Exactly. So do you more come from the pressure argument or the biblical, or a mixture of both?
Both. Because when I was making the clues, I got grief from the Christian community. I was raised born again evangelical Christian. You know, church was not just a Sunday thing. You know, there was youth group, there was vacation Bible school, there was Camp Malibu during the summer, and so on and so on. But when I left my very secluded island up near Canada, I fell away from that for obvious reasons. One, because I was sheltered and now I wasn't sheltered anymore. And two, that I got into the tech world. I mean, I played video games for a living. And so we were, you know, nobody in my crew went to church ever. And so the Christian community came at me and said, you're kind of bobbing and weaving and dancing around the whole God issue. You have to address this in the clues. And so I said, you know what? You're right. So I made a clue called They Are Hiding God. And I said, okay, here's my opinion on it, which is science has a vested interest to protect its foundation. And if they found, like a lot of things, right, there's some things that can be hidden. I mean, the you got to remember how the end of Indiana Jones, the Raiders of the Lost Ark was, where they put it in a cardboard box or put it in a wooden box and they put it in a warehouse and no one ever saw it again.
Exactly. Right?
They had a vested interest in hiding this world the way it was, mostly because by the time they figured it out, which was about 1960, it was too late. It was, you know, found the foundation of the world had been cast, the concrete had hardened, and they weren't going to take any chances. People in power don't take those sort of chances. So, and I agreed with them. It's like 1960, that was only 13 years after Roswell. No, they weren't going to roll those dice. So they just said it was one of the shortest Illuminati meetings ever. It was like, what could go wrong? And right, and people are going, oh, economically, academically, religiously. And then finally some guy at the end who was smoking, because they all do, as well, yeah, we're not going to tell anybody for a while. So let's just keep a wrap, you know, keep this under wraps for a while. And they did for a long, long time until just recently.
So what happened in 1960?
Oh, yeah, sorry. 1960 was when the Antarctic Treaty was roughly 1960. So what happened was, imagine you had the maps of what this world looked like, going all the way back to, I don't know, 1600s France, right? You could have been the most powerful man in Europe. What are you going to do with it? You got wooden ships, you got horses. You don't have the tech to do anything. You can't go down to Antarctica. You'd die. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible place to go to. So it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution, and most notably, not until the internal combustion engine was made before they could even verify the old maps, which was, and they sent Admiral Richard Byrd, to the North Pole, 1926. And whatever he found, despite, doesn't matter if you believe the myths or the legends or whatever he found up there freaked him out so bad that he said, okay, you're going to Antarctica and you're just going to start flying. You're going to fly and fly. We're going to send you better planes and better planes and better planes. And that's all he did. The rest of his career, off and on, he just kept going. He flew down there from 1926 all the way up until 1956. Flew around in doing Navy missions down there looking for what I call the outer barrier or the outer marker. You know, getting refueling stations, just keep flying and flying. And at one point, I think they gave up. I think they were like, he's been flying down there for 30 years. Can't find anything. We got to shut this thing down, right? So he goes on television in 1954 for a wonderful show. It was like the 60 Minutes of his day, called the Long Jeans. I pronounced it wrong. I pronounced it Long Jines, and I had older people calling me up. It's Long Jeans. It's a watch. You should know this. Like, I don't. Long Jeans Chronoscope. You know, watchmakers. Popular because a watchmaker is sponsoring a television show in America.
Yes, yes.
Apparently they did. And he was on there, and he was talking about the very next mission, which was Operation Deep Freeze, 1955 to 1956. And he was prepping for it. He'd sent recon teams down there. And he was talking about all this stuff that was going on in Antarctica. You know, it was all these countries down there, and they found a mountain range made out of coal and oil and uranium, which he wasn't supposed to talk about. And he's going, I think we may even go to war down there before it's over. You know, there's all so much stuff to go after. And he goes down there during Operation Deep Freeze. And then right after that, everybody, you know, after all those things he said about all the countries, you know, fighting over Antarctica, everything just stopped, meaning they just locked that place down. Of course, that's Murphy's Law, right? So everyone's getting ready, and all of a sudden, I'm not saying he found frost giants in front of a giant gate, right? Anything like that. But whatever it was, they started drawing up the Antarctic Treaty almost immediately. And the Antarctic Treaty, which was ratified in 1959, the exact same time as when Van Allen from NASA said that, oh yeah, the Van Allen belts, no one should ever go up, ever, for any reason. Super deadly up there, horrible, horrible radiation, no one should go up. Think about what happened in 1959. They seal off the outer marker and the upper marker simultaneously. The odds that NASA was founded in 1958. And the high, and then on a side note, the high altitude atomic weapons program was started in 1958. Where a lot of people don't realize that the United States and USSR were firing nukes. All the tests from 1958 until 1962 were straight up just firing nukes. Why were they firing? Because that's what men do, right? You know, it's like you find the outer marker. No. Think about this. You find outer marker. What's the first thing? It's like, well, that's a really big looking wall. Get the cannon.
Yeah, exactly. Let's fire at it.
Yeah, cannon's not working. Like, oh, what else we got? We got rockets. It's like, you know what? grab one of those new things. and seriously, the first two or three shots were in the low megaton range. This was back when megatons were a pricey proposition, right? Not nowadays, where you can get megatons down at 7-Eleven. Well, after that, it was low, medium kiloton range. And I knew what they were doing. They were painting the sky. Basically, they were shooting paintballs at the ceiling, trying to figure out the measurements, because eventually they were going to have to figure out how far they could go. Because eventually you're going to, after those first three shots, that's when NASA was founded. Once they figured out, it's like, well, get anything bigger than megaton? No. Well, all right. Got a fake space, I guess. So they did, and that's how the program started up. And they militarized space, which was brilliant. Why? Because NASA is a collection of parts. Don't forget that the NASA is just it's a military organization, but they get all their parts from, you know, Lockheed Martin and McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and General Dynamics and those guys. Well, those are the guys with the stuff. What you don't want to happen is that you don't militarize space, and then some day down the road, you have Lockheed Martin teaming up with, I don't know, Frito-Lay to put some sort of weird banner on the moon, right? It's like, and then all of a sudden they keep crashing. You know, and they're like, it's like, why do our rockets keep blowing up? It's like, oh, I don't know. You don't want that conversation to happen. Yeah, so yeah. In a very short amount of time, so after the Antarctic thing, the Antarctic Treaty, so let me back up for a second. The Antarctic Treaty says that no one can go to Antarctica from a corporate standpoint. No corporation can set up shop in Antarctica forever. Forever. And it's not a hard treaty to find. It's online. It's the only unbroken treaty in the history of treaties. And it's not even up for review until 2041. Right? And it was founded in 1959. Not even up for review until 2041. Why? You know... And that was one of the big red flags for me when I was making the clues, was only because I'm from America, right? Which is, look, the world runs on greed and money and power. It's how it's run. It's always, you know, capitalism, you know, wins all the time. But you're telling me no matter how much money my company has, I can't do anything in Antarctica? I mean, come on. If you're an oil and gas company, right, you have gobs of liquid resources on your hands, right? Yeah. If you wanted to start fracking in your neighbor's backyard tomorrow, maybe not tomorrow, but next week, you could make that happen in most places, and it has. I mean, come on, they've just rolled through. Any place you can frack, they have fracked. But those same companies, not only are they not allowed to go down there, this is the part that blew me away, they're not even allowed to talk about it. That's the part. You're not even allowed to do those, you know, run a full page ad. Like, let's say British Petroleum. Perfect example. British Petroleum. You should be running full page ads in the London Times month after month after month, saying how great it would be, you know, to set up shop in Antarctica. Loads of resources and jobs and, you know, better living for Britons. They're not even allowed to talk about it. They're not even allowed to protest. And the reason, again, it's an easy thing to do. You just have someone in the government contact the head and CEO of whatever company and say, okay, so because of national security, and I can't tell you why, you can't go down there ever. And whoever replaces you, you have to give them my business card, and then we will talk to that person as well. And this goes on in perpetuity, right? So that's how it works. And it's brilliant. It's an easy enough plan. And the reason why you do this is because of a simple argument, which is you let's say you have British Petroleum or Exxon or Mobil or whoever is down there, right? These guys have resources. They have equipment. Plane goes off course. Goes off course a lot. And then see submit shouldn't. Well, that's a loose end. How many loose ends do you have to... I mean, that was, again, a short Illuminati meeting. It's like, so, you know, it's like, what about helicopters? And then all of a sudden, you know, the table of people start talking. It's like, what about this? And it's like, well, they got, you know, what sort of technology are we talking about? And then finally someone, it's always some guy at the end of the table goes, look, just shut it down. Just close it off. No one goes down there. The oil company's like, yeah, we're going to lose a lot of money. We're talking probably, you know, $1 trillion in oil at least. It's like, don't care. Don't care. The publicity, it's too much. It's too much, too many loose ends to hold up. Plus, let's say somebody makes it out of there. Right? You know, one of those movie scenes where somebody, you know, with a plane goes off course, the transponder dies, and then they make it back to civilization. No, never, ever going to happen. So that's why Antarctica has been shut down forever. It's just too risky. And the same logic would be, let's go over to the NASA side of things. It was the same logic behind why there was never any stars in any of the moon photos.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was, it's an easy enough thing. And I'll take that and I'll jump over to the YouTube thing, which is a great argument. So you have the stars, right? But then you got nerds that are sitting at the sidelines going, you know, the Belt of Orion is going to be in the wrong place at this particular time during the day. It's like, no one's going to, it's like, I noticed. It's like, oh God. So, and it's like, you can't do the math, right? All the shots will be way too tough to do. I mean, again, if a star is out of place, even in the slightest, right?
Yep.
It's, and this, we're talking about 1969. And so finally somebody says, just no stars. Just don't even put it. And it's like, what do we say about the no stars? Well, it's an exposure setting. Yeah, but wouldn't there be an exposure saying that would show stars? Doesn't matter. It'll just tell the astronauts they never saw stars. It's like, all right. And it worked. The same thing goes along with, and I know I'm kind of ranting here, but the same thing goes along with the spacesuits. Look up, yeah. If you ever get a chance, look up the early videos of spacesuits in the mid-1950s when they were trying to design the early space program, which was, they were all really, really heavy plastic or metal or hybrids, and they had to be because of the whole pressure thing, right? You can't use a soft suit because it would just turn into a parade float, you know, and they just tip over and they, you know, the thing would burst open. And then some genius, well, probably not a nerd, probably some guy at the end, it's like, what if we just use a soft suit and we just put it on TV? And it's like, because people would notice, like, Americans don't know much about physics. We go through high school after high school. We don't teach much about physics, right? They're never going to figure that out. And I'll be damned if that didn't work. Because it doesn't matter how many people I have talked to, and I, especially out of this country, if I leave the United States and I go talk to people, I go, yeah, I get why Americans believe in the moon missions, right? Rah, rah, wave the flag, we're the greatest, right? But why are you in Sweden? Why do you believe that the Americans went to the moon? And everybody, no matter what country, they say the same thing. And they go, well, because it was on television. And I go,
oh, yeah. Interesting.
I go, really? And they, and I go, there's lots of things on television. Yeah, but this was the news. The news is never fake. And I go, and then I try to get away from the fake news argument. And I say, because the Americans would never lie about anything, ever. I'll give you a quick perception thing real fast, which is when I was doing an Egypt thing to look at the pyramids, I was running into these group of high schoolers and they were looking at me like I was some sort of demigod. And I was like, and this was before Flat Earth, right? I'm going, what's the deal with the kids, right? And it's like, oh, you're the first Americans they've seen outside of television. And I go, and so what? I go, everyone's television's television. I go, and it occurred to me, I go, what kind of shows do you watch over here? And they go, oh, you know, all the good American shows. Dallas, Dynasty, Falcon's Crest. It's like, I go, what do you mean? Where all the Americans are incredibly rich millionaires and sometimes billionaires? It's like, yeah, that's what it's like, isn't it? I go, yeah, now I can see why everyone wants to get American visas. They still call it the New World.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, exactly. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. That's what we're here for, to hear you talk. So how did the narrative morph from militarizing space / lying about it to sort of epitomizing our insignificance?
Kind of one and the same, in that when you reinforce space over and over and over again, you're without even condemning religion, you are creating a model of the universe that is so vast and so incomprehensibly, since it supposedly has no borders, you can't literally get your head around it, right? That's one of the reasons, one of the allures of Flat Earth, in that you say, oh yeah, by the way, in this, a universe with so many zeros at the end of it that it's meaningless, that the math is meaningless. You are a tiny little rock covered in a tiny little bit of water and an even tinier little bit of smoke flying through it at impossible velocities, and you could be snuffed out at any given time. Now forget about the asteroids, gamma burst, your sun going supernova, you know, binary star collision, whatever it is, just all sorts of alien invasion, that's so far down the list. And yet we still make movies about it because it's more interesting. But during that process, when you do that, you diminish everything, including everything on the earth, including religion. Religion is just a fantasy. It's just a wish. It's just hopeful thinking. That's all it really is. And that helps science. I mean, it helps build. The only thing that doesn't work in their favor, thank God for the masses, is that the intellectuals, the people that follow science to their ultimate end, which is, you know, your master's or your PhD and being published in whatever discipline, is that you're still the minority. And I try to make that very clear to the science people I've run into. I go, you know, it doesn't matter. All the high schools that I had to deal with over the years, I go, chess club was pretty small. And the physics club was even smaller. I go, these were very, very small groups. I go, the reason why flat earth has such a broad appeal is because the audience is very, very broad. Meaning the clues, again, I lucked out because of the training I had professionally, is that I used to teach proprietary software to blue collar factories, different parts of the country. And you learn that even though your software is made by nerds and very, very expensive and very broad and very complicated, they are only going to use probably 10% of it. You got to figure out what 10% it is and then dumb it down to where you can explain it to someone who's, no offense, is, you know, has got a name tag on their chest. And, you know, again, people that don't use a lot of computers. This was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And apply that to flat earth. You know, when I made the clues, I took the flat earth concept and took the solar system model and just erased it from the blackboard and drew in very large font with almost no math. I don't think I even used math in the clues at all. Just said, okay, here's why I think it's flat earth. It's really easy to understand. Here's A plus B plus C, you know, and so on. And I'm going to start really slow for you. And it was easy to digest chunks. The videos were not even 15 minutes long. Very, very short. And I, you know, spoke in a very soothing, you know, tried to make the delivery as clear as possible. Didn't try to get, okay, it's flat earth. You know, I didn't try to, you know, lose my stuff. And it resonated. With a lot, the cross section was amazing, the amount of people. Now, granted, I knew the limitations. Anyone that had a bachelor's degree in a physical science or higher was immune to it, absolutely immune. And if you had a master's degree or higher in a physical science, it was over. In fact, if you had a master's degree in anything, you're pretty much done. But if you had a bachelor's degree in not a physical science, which a lot of people do, you had a chance. You could get your head around it. But what I did was, you know, again, condensed the whole cosmos down to a snow globe, which I thought there was going to be like a small percentage, and I had no scientific basis for this. There was a small percentage of people that were going to freak out and lose it. Maybe like, you know, crawl into a bottle in a fetal position and like, oh no. But that's not what happened. In fact, it crunches everything back down, but it's very comforting to a lot of people, which is simultaneously, it turns the whole universe into a studio apartment, but it's very comfortable and it was meant just for them. It's like a studio apartment with your name on the door. Yeah. And that is really reassuring to a whole bunch of people. And that was wonderful to see. So
I think it's interesting that the Christian community, and nothing, no offense to any Christian out there, but that they really, I never heard any Christian, like my grandma or anything like that, ever mention flat earth or the firmament or anything like that. But as soon as the flat earth movement started gaining traction, it seemed like a lot of Christians really leapt onto it. And it's not like Christianity is the only religion cosmology that is talked about flat earth, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I've got some wonderful, I'm sure David showed you some wonderful images, just about every culture, even the Greeks, even though people's like, oh, no, the Greeks discovered, it's like, screw the Greeks. Don't worry about the Greeks. Everybody else drew the same thing, which was some sort of snow globe. But the Christian community, especially in the United States, really latched onto it. Because in fact, there were several flat earth Christian conventions that I was not even invited to because I wasn't Christian enough, which I thought was amazing. I don't think David was invited either, but they latched onto it because if you have a belief, if you are strong, you know, in the belief of a creator, but you're only like 93%, give or take, this will take you another 4 or 5%. And for a lot of people, that's more than enough to tip the scales even further. And so the Christian community, again, which gave me so much grief about not dealing with it, once I made the video called They Are Hiding God, they just, well, the late Rob Skiba, he was one of the first guys. He was a big biblical prophecy guy. And once he got into it, he went through the Bible with a fine tooth comb. Might as well have been a flat earth comb. And when he was done, he called me up. He goes, yeah, it's a flat earth book. I go, really? I go, I didn't know. I mean, I don't know every chapter and verse, not by a long shot. And he goes, no, he goes, the only verse in the Bible that even hints at a globe is Isaiah 40:22, he who sitteth upon the circle of the earth. He goes, but in Hebrew, he goes, circle's not globe, it's not ball, it's not sphere, it's a completely different word. Dinner plate is circular, or your dining room table is circular, hubcaps and everything else. He goes, that's it. And what, unfortunately, and maybe it was by design, there were so many pastors out there that just held on to that Isaiah verse like grim death. It's like it had veto power over the entire rest of the Bible. And it's like, really? Over Genesis? Because Genesis talked about the firmament. It's like, no, Isaiah. Because they were afraid of the backlash. That was the big drawback of Flat Earth is it's so polarizing that it polarizes everybody. Doesn't matter who it is. So pastors are afraid to talk to their congregations about it because they're afraid of losing the audience. Like anyone up on, you know, anyone up in front of a microphone, they're afraid of losing the audience. Heck, before David got on Alex Jones, they contacted me 4 years earlier. 4 years earlier, right? And the producer meeting was so weird. They go, okay, how long can we do a show about Flat Earth without actually saying Flat Earth? I go, what? I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. If I do a tap dance, maybe. And it's like, yeah, we can't take the risk. Sorry, can't do it.
What?
And yeah,
Alex Jones?
Alex Jones. And but he wasn't alone. I mean, there were a number of producers from different areas that were just scared to death of being tied to it because they weren't sure. They were nervous about the audience backlash. Hell, the first conference we did down in Raleigh back in 2017, which is where the finale of the documentary was, Howard Stern sent a team down there and he would not go down to it himself because he didn't want to get, you know, lumped up in that. It's like, why are you here? And people, in fact, it was the media was so weird. The first day of the conference, a lot of people don't know, you'll send recon producers to whatever event, usually the first day. And there were all these recon producers walking around the conference because they didn't think it was real, right? They didn't think it was like a real thing. And then all of a sudden you could just see them. It's like picking up their phones within the first 30 minutes going, yeah, you got to send some people down here like right now. And the next day, the whole lobby was just jammed. I mean, I was wearing 3 hot mics simultaneously.
Wow.
And I had no idea who I was talking to at one point. Eventually we settled the main clip we used was ABC News. But everybody else, I mean, they flew in from France and Germany and England. It was awesome. So, cool. Yeah. But polarization, big problem for our team.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Do you think another reason that they want to keep people away from Antarctic is because of what might be beyond it? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Some people believe that the outside of the ring, there's another whole ring of different...
Yeah. I mean the wonderful story, the Iron Republic. I don't know if it's real or not, but it's a great story about civilizations that live beyond our civilization. Do I think one of the reasons I get to do this, some of the things I do is I put myself in the shoes of other people. A lot of empathy. So I will actually put my mind in the heads of, we'll just say the Illuminati for better, or let's call them the Authority. Right. Because nobody knows who it's at. The first rule of power is stay hidden. Nobody knows who's at the very top.
Yes.
I think the Vatican's probably up there, but it's probably some European family you've never, ever heard of because the first rule of power is, again, stay hidden.
Yes.
So I think for them, the big thing was let's just not take the chance. So like with the oil companies or private companies, all it takes is one group to go off rails, you know, to go off road, and then you don't know what you don't want to keep track of them. So do I think physically that they had the technology maybe even 20 years ago to make it to the outer marker? Nah, doubt it. But you're not going to take that chance. Why risk it? It's kind of like mob thinking. You know, what was that one line? It was a Robert De Niro line. If there ever is a doubt, there is no doubt. Right? Meaning you don't roll the dice. You do not take those chances.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I like that idea, or that idea makes sense to me, because a lot of people are going, well, if the cabal or whatever you want to call them are chemtrailing us to death or poisoning the earth, so on and so forth, like they live here too. So why would they poison their own well? Well, if they have someplace else to go, that would make sense.
Yeah, I've toyed with that idea as well. The only problem I have with it is eventually you're going to have a bunch of these, whoever they are, disappear. Sure.
And that seems as good a place as any to end the first free hour. To hear the second hour and 20 or so minutes, go to patreon.com/themeltpodcast. And for as little as $3 measly dollars a month, you can get access to full episodes, early episodes, and exclusive episodes. And also, you will be able to join the conversation that we have every month at the Melt Meetup. Yes, in the second hour, we talked about the cabal behind the cabal, Admiral Byrd, ambient globalism, celebrity flat earthers, flat earth as positive conspiracy theory, and you get to hear Hunter and I's commentary and a lot more. Thank you all so very, very much for listening. Hopefully you were able to glean something positive from this and maybe learn a little bit. I don't know. Maybe have your suspicions confirmed. Whatever the case may be, I hope it's positive. And there is a lot of great stuff coming your way. So stay tuned. And until next time, take care, people. If you've liked what you've heard and would like to contribute to The Melt, there are a few ways that you can do that. The most tangible would be financially. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and there you will find ways that you can contribute for as little as $3 a month. This will give you access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. Contributing financially will also help make The Melt better, pay the bills, and help to make this podcast a full-time endeavor that I can fully devote my time to and provide you with more content. Another way of contributing would be to go to wherever it is that you subscribe to The Melt and give it a favorable review or rating, and this will help it to reach more people. You can also spread the word to friends and family via social media, email, or word of mouth. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.